little anecdote I want to begin with, which is reported by the late Giorgio Amendola, who was the leader of the Italian Communist Party, and who was in the 1930s in exile doing political work in Paris. He reports that sometime, doesn't say exactly when, Togliatti, who was then better known as Ercoli, his, so to speak, official name in the Comintern, came to him and said, "You've got to go to Cambridge and pick up something for me." So he went to Cambridge, to Trinity College, where he met the famous economist Piero Sraffa, who was, of course, an Italian, and who gave him, after giving him the usual tourist guide of Cambridge and all the rest, who gave him a package and said, "Do you know what's in that?" He said, "No, I've got no idea." He said, "Well, anyway, here's the package." And he brought it back to Paris and gave it to Togliatti. And there, Togliatti took this little package, and he says, "I can still see him getting pale and with trembling hands trying to undo the knot until he couldn't do it anymore and he just cut it." And then in that little package there were handwritten leaves. And he forgot about my presence, and he immediately launched into sort of avidly reading the thing. And at a certain point he turned to me and he said, "Do you know what these are? These are the letters of Gramsci." And then he caught himself, because he wasn't supposed to say anything, and said, "For God's sake, you mustn't say this to anybody. This is absolutely strict discretion." This is the way in which the man who was even then the leader of the Italian Communist Party and a leading figure in the international, and became an important one, regarded the writings of his imprisoned comrade. Now, who was this man who even then from jail was had so clearly so important an effect on his friend and you could almost say his disciple? What I'm going to say is probably well known to the more academically and politically trained of you, but that's no reason for not saying it. Gramsci is by now unusually well known in at least the academic circles in this country. When the first Gramsci conference was held in Rome in 1958, 20 years or so after his death, and I was invited there, and I was asked at short notice to say something about Gramsci in England, and all I could say, I said it in about 2 minutes, is that we knew, or some of us knew, that Gramsci is very important, but nobody really knew very much about him. And that was true. Even then, more was known about Gramsci in England, or in the English-speaking world, than elsewhere. The situation today is entirely different. There is a vast literature, and once again, in the English-speaking world, a very much larger literature about Gramsci and publication of Gramsci's writings, probably than anywhere except in Italy itself. Now, I don't want to enter into the elaborate theoretical debates which have been based on these of his writings, or on the arguments about his theoretical relations with Marx and Lenin and Croce and Sorel and the other people, because this is a subject for an academic seminar, and just in purely quantitative terms, this is a bit big to be a seminar. I don't even want to talk in the broadest sense about Gramsci and Marxist theory. What I do want to do is, in some ways to explain, in my view, why I think Gramsci is important to us today, not merely as academic theorists, but as socialists. And if anybody wants to find out more about it, in fact, we happen to have an exceedingly good selection of Gramsci's writings, particularly the Prison Men books, which was published in the 70s by Lawrence and Wishart, edited by Hoare and Noel Smith, with very good, excellent explanatory notes. There's also an extremely good introduction to a lot of Gramsci's thought, edited by Anne Shostak-Sassoon, called Approaches to Gramsci, in which, incidentally, I've written a piece, some of which, of course, I shall be, as it were, repeating with variations. Now, who was Gramsci? For the benefit of those who don't remember or don't know, he was, I suppose, of all the leading communists and Marxist leaders, the one who was born with the opposite of a silver spoon in his mouth. Nobody started off with less in the way of advantages. He started off in extreme poverty, born of in an extremely backward, almost a third world corner of Sardinia, which is even by the standards of the backward parts of the Mediterranean not in the vanguard of progress. In his infancy, he was dropped, and in fact, this turned him into a lifetime semi-dwarf cripple. He worked like crazy. He moved to Turin, not as a socialist, if anything, as a young man, he was, as you might expect, a sort of Sardinian regionalist or nationalist, as you might say. He probably didn't even talk Italian until he actually learned it at school. And in Turin, he studied and gradually got himself involved in the labor movement. In fact, he joined the Socialist Party in or around 1913, and gradually between then and the Russian Revolution found himself increasingly active, so much so that he dropped out of the university before concluding his degree, which in any case he had to study in the hardest conceivable circumstances as a miserably poor outside student. Turin gave him two major advantages. Firstly, it was the main center of modern industry and therefore of the formation of a modern proletariat in Italy. It was, and is today, the city of the Fiat Works. And this gave him, in a sense, an experience which it would have been hard to get in any other Italian city, and indeed in many other parts of Europe. And secondly, it contained an extremely active group of intellectuals in and around an excellent university with whom Gramsci made friends and, in some instances, important political connections. They were partly liberals, like Piero Gobetti, but very largely they were socialists, Marxists, revolutionaries, and among these friends, of course, there were people like Palmiro Togliatti, Terracini, people, again, like Piero Sraffa, the economist, all of whom he got to know in and around the student circles and the political student circles. He then, in fact, became essentially a leader of the Turin movement and a leader of the Communist Party, and I will spare you the detailed discussions of the early history of the Communist Party. It's enough to say that after considerable internal struggles in and around Gramsci and Togliatti and a number of other of his friends essentially based on the Turin group, which in turn had been based on the newspaper, the Ordine Nuovo, the New Order, and the people basing on the Turin working class, became the leadership, the new leadership of the Italian Communist Party. In the meantime, he had gone to Moscow, to the International, where he had in fact married. He came back to Italy, and in 1926 he was arrested and spent the remainder of his life in a fascist jail, where he died. He had only one stroke of luck. When he went into jail, his friend Sraffa, who by this time had got out of Italy and in fact eventually settled in Cambridge, where he spent the rest of his life, Sraffa, who came from a relatively well-off family, opened an open account for him with the Milan bookshop, which enabled him to order books and periodicals so that he would be able to read inside jail. He was not allowed to write for another 2 or 3 years by the fascist jailers, but thanks to the ability to read and to order books, and thanks to maintaining a slight contact with the outside world through his sister-in-law Tatiana and through Sraffa, he was able to concentrate. And between 1929 and 1934, he read and he wrote in a feverish manner, I mean, everything that he possibly could, and it is this, essentially, it is on these writings that his reputation is today based. Even in jail, he wasn't lucky. He found himself out of sympathy with the line of the Communist International in what was its most sectarian and suicidal phase, the so-called third period, and was consequently, even in jail for a time, he was isolated by the loyal comrades who believed that at all costs the international, the official line must be preserved. Nevertheless, as my initial anecdote shows you, it did not mean that the important leaders of the Italian movement in fact failed to appreciate him and to learn from him. And he, in the last 2 or 3 years, he was too ill even to write, and he died in March 1937, and this is the real occasion for celebrating, as it were, commemorating the 50 years after his death. So much then for the background. Now, this background accounts for a number of peculiarities in Gramsci's situation which are relevant to the interest and the value of his thinking as a politician. In the first place, he was an intellectual from a desperately poor and backward background, unlike most intellectuals in communist parties who came from middle-class backgrounds and joined the movement. It's very important that the background of coming from really dark, backward, impoverished villages in a really in the lost corners of a really lost island, to giving him a sense, if you like, of the problems, a real lived sense of the problems of poverty. Secondly, he was one of the few Marxists who were both theorists and leaders of a mass party. That's to say, whose theory was based on practical experience as a leader of a major party and not of a small and illegal group or sect. Marx and Engels had no such political experience, they could not have had. The main leaders of the Second International who had such experience were rarely theorists. In the Second International there was a curious pigeonhole for people called theorists, which was filled most notably by Karl Kautsky. Everybody listened to them, but in actual fact they were not actually doing the organizing and the mobilizing. And this is not a criticism of them, it's simply to show that there was a difference. The people who did the main organizing, people like Bebel or the old Liebknecht or Victor Adler and the others, were politicians but not necessarily tremendously learned in the theory or original theorists. the Russians before 1917 had only a small illegal cadre party, and consequently their experience of actually running a major labor movement, except at the rarest moments, was inevitably limited. And of course the communist parties after 1920, outside the Soviet Union, tended, I believe quite mistakenly, to assimilate the functions of leadership and theorist. And the leader became the theorist, and consequently you get all sorts of things like multi-volume editions of the speeches and articles of somebody like Maurice Thorez, of which the more important had been ghosted anyway by advisors, on the assumption that anything that the official leader says must be of major theoretical interest, which isn't quite the same thing. However, in the case of Gramsci, we do have an example of a man with a very fine and original theoretical brain who, at the same time, knew what actually the problem of organizing a mass movement for a mass revolutionary party, a mass proletarian movement, was about. Thirdly, I'm afraid, he was one of the few of the such theorist leaders who had the leisure for theoretical reflection and was not constantly involved, plunged into the day-by-day politics, which of course most active leaders are. And that was because he was unlucky enough to be in jail for 10 years. I mean, he couldn't actually do what he would have had to do if he'd have been outside. And this, in a sense, means that he was able to look at things in a slightly longer perspective. And fourthly, and this is perhaps a bit more controversial, he was formed in, he was not formed in the classic mode of Marxism as it developed in the Second International, and in which even the Bolsheviks were formed, must be said. He came out of it quite differently. He came to Marxism, as a matter of fact, via the Russian Revolution. Before then, he was rather against it because he thought it was a sort of economic determinist thing. It did not allow sufficient role for human action. He didn't know enough about it at that time, but this was undoubtedly what people could very likely conclude. And it was only through the Russian Revolution, where the revolutionary element in Marxism had been preserved, that, as it were, Western European Marxist revolutionaries once again, from being mostly before the First World War syndicalists or semi-anarchists, began to rediscover that here was a revolutionary rather than a social democratic tradition, as they said. So, in a sense, he came without, as it were, his own approach to Marxism, was a different one, and he didn't have to dismantle a large amount of traditional, so to speak, Kautskyan accretions on the thought of Marx before he could start thinking. There are enormous arguments about how far he is a Leninist or not. Anyway, he thought he was a Leninist, and he thought it was Lenin who had, in fact, inspired his kind of Marxism. But one point is clear. He had one, if you like, advantage for us over Lenin. Lenin was unquestionably an enormously original Marxist in the 20th century, and never hesitated to change his analysis when he saw that the actual situation required it, that it wasn't any good keeping on the old formula, except that for reasons which I won't go into, which one could speculate, Lenin invariably believed, or at least talked, as though his innovations were entirely compatible with the literal truth of every text of Marx or of his predecessors. Indeed, up to about 1912, even of Kautsky. So he's a combination of officially utter orthodoxy, including textual orthodoxy, went before, but in fact, if you actually go into it, tremendous originality. Now, Gramsci didn't actually believe that he had to make his thinking compatible with whatever Marx or Engels or somebody else had written in 1867 or 19, partly because he couldn't read them in fascist jail. So, to this extent, he could let his originality show more in some ways. That doesn't mean he wasn't a Marxist. Being a good Marxist is not, we have learnt it the hard way, being a good Marxist is not just showing how right some past text was. There are two other points I want to make. Firstly, of course, or rather, if you like, it's fine. Fifthly, he came from a country which united the problems of the modern capitalist industrial world, as in Turin, and the modern third world. If you came from Sardinia, you knew what the problems of backwardness and of underdevelopment and all these were. So, in a sense, his theory is capable. Indeed, one of the most, for historians, one of the most original bits of Gramsci is precisely the way in which he understands the problems of writing the history of understanding the problems of, say, a peasant society and a highly traditional backward peasant society. And finally, he came from a country which faced more dramatically than any other the basic problem of communists after 1917. Namely, what do revolutionaries do when the revolution they'd hoped to make hasn't happened? More, when, as in Italy, it had failed to take place in spite of the presence of most objective conditions for it. In spite of actually trying to take place. In spite of a revolutionary situation, in spite of the occupation of the factories, it failed. And this implied a second question, which he also considered. What happens when an essentially successful Soviet revolution remains isolated in the world? What effect does it have on this isolating socialist society as well as on the rest? Why did the revolution in Europe fail? What do we do now? What is the outlook? What is more, within a few years of being in jail, that initial failure of the revolution in most of Europe was underlined by a second and equally dramatic failure. Capitalism plunged into the great slump, which was probably the only genuinely system-endangering economic crisis that we've had in the history of capitalism, and it led not, as many people thought it was going to be, to an immediate upsurge of revolution, but in the short run, to the triumph of international fascism and a number of other things. And in fact, it was very typical that it was between 1929 and 1933 that Gramsci was constantly, was in fact, doing most of his writing. Now, all Gramsci's thinking is, of course, determined by this major question. Let me take as an example the term hegemony, which is a key idea in Gramsci. Now, he pretty certainly took this term over from Lenin, who didn't invent it because it had been current coin in the debates of the Russian revolutionaries for years. But for Lenin, for instance, in his two tactics of social democracy, which I think is where Gramsci got it from, hegemony meant the willingness of the peasantry to follow the lead set by the working class, as it were. He saw it in terms of the advance of the revolution. The Gramscian term, quite apart from being more elaborate, is essentially used to explain not just what the workers have got to do to get forward, but also why it is so difficult to overthrow capitalism. See, why capitalism appears to be so resistant even in a period of revolutionary crisis. Now, the specific background of Gramsci thought, the need to rethink our position in the light of a historical failure naturally tends to make Gramsci congenial to people who operate in analogous conditions, and who therefore also have to do a bit of rethinking of what to do at a time when hopes have not been realized. For the left in general, and the British left in particular, we do face an analogous problem. And nothing is more useless than to deny a setback or a defeat. What's the use of talking about, what was the use of talking about 8.5 million who were said to have voted for socialism in 1983, as Tony Benn did? Not that the 8.5 million did vote for socialism in any real sense, when the reality was that Labour had lost more than 1/4 of its supporters. What's the use of concentrating on the heroism of the miners' 12-month struggle, which is absolutely undoubted, when the reality is also that of a union led into division and defeat by bad or wrong generalship, which overrode the advice of some communist miners' leaders, whose qualifications as left-wingers and as union leaders were as good as those of the people who actually set the strategy. Nothing is more useless than to talk as though the workers were still what they were in 1950. And the whole essence of Gramsci is that he started off by saying, right, what we had hoped for hasn't happened now. Where do we go? But in fact, of course, the value of Gramsci's thinking lies not only in suggesting the need for new strategic perspectives for a movement which failed to make headway with the old ones. This, incidentally, doesn't mean that we treat the present situation in any significant sense as similar to the one in which Gramsci lived. Nobody today should or could claim the textual authority of Gramsci for their policies. And I myself have, even 10 years ago, said that it is totally wrong to regard Gramsci as a Euro-communist, you know, before his time. It would have been absolutely senseless to introduce the situation of the 1970s, whatever we think of it, into the situation of the 20s and 30s in which Gramsci wrote. So it's irrelevant to speculate what Gramsci would have been today. That isn't the business. It's how we should think about the problems. The interest in Gramsci is indeed broader than the strategic one. In fact, he suggests new strategic perspectives because he has added new, or at least emphasized previously neglected, dimensions of Marxist thinking. And I shall mention some of these. I'll deliberately not say anything much about what Gramsci can contribute to our economic analysis, because he wasn't primarily an economic thinker or analyst, even though, as I say, one of his closest friends, with whom he exchanged important opinions, namely Serafa, was an economist and an extremely distinguished one, and they corresponded on this matter. The main emphasis of his thought was always, and it's always imbued with history, was political and social and cultural. Even so, it will not do to underestimate his contribution even in the economic field, because he was one of the first communist thinkers to come to terms with what he recognized, even in the late 20s, as a new phase of capitalist development, more than just, as most communists and most socialists thought, a temporary, quote-unquote, temporary stabilization of the same old capitalism. And in his writings on Americanism and Fordism, which really in some instances show him at his most original, he recognized this, and these writings do repay reading for that for that reason. At the very least, he does remind us that capitalism doesn't just work or break down under what are essentially the same internal contradictions, but that its capacity to survive and flourish is based on a high degree of adaptability and capacity to change. But unfortunately, in this respect, he doesn't any longer tell us anything that we need to be told. We have learned that this is so. The fact that, for instance, we have been for 10 years or more living in a major global capitalist crisis, analogous, at least as serious in its way as the one in the 30s, and nobody any longer seriously argues as though the imminent collapse of the system is immediately round the corner, shows that to this extent we no longer expect, we are no longer as simple-minded in our expectations as a lot of people were in 1930-32. I shan't either say a great deal about, or anything, about what Marx, what Gramsci wrote about intellectuals. He wrote a great deal about intellectuals. In fact, I dare say most people in this hall are intellectuals, and one reason why Gramsci, well, a lesser reason why Gramsci is very popular, is that he, quite rightly, unlike a lot of other people who downgraded intellectuals, he didn't. He said they were absolutely essential in politics, including in the politics of revolutionary and socialist movements. Nevertheless, I shan't say much about it, partly because here I am heterodox. I do not really believe that what Gramsci writes about intellectuals, and particularly the distinction between traditional and organic intellectuals, is quite as important as he evidently thought it is. I'm quite likely quite wrong about this, but nevertheless, it gives me at least an excuse for saying I'm not going to write and talk a great deal on this now. His major contributions are in the field of political theory and politics. And I'll mention about five of these points, if you like, in which it is central for Marxists and indeed for everyone on the left. The first, which is very general, is that Gramsci makes politics, in many respects, into the central, gives it a central importance, a much more central importance than do most other Marxists. And I think he is probably right in doing so. As Hoare and Noel Smith rightly point out, he sees it as the central human activity, the means by which the single consciousness is brought into contact with the social and natural world in all its forms, and so it's much wider than ordinary politics, but in this sense, political relations of individuals and political activities are for Gramsci central, and I believe it is very important for Marxists to see them as much more important than traditional Marxist theory allows. And I shall return to this point. The second point is, of course, or the second area, key area, is the theory of hegemony, about which I shall say a little more. As you know, he argues that the domination of the ruling class is not only based on economic power and state power, the state being defined as it was by, not only by Marx, but also by Max Weber, as essentially as a system of physical coercion. It's not only based on economic power and state power in this sense, but also on getting the system of the ruling class, i.e. capitalism, and the rulers themselves, accepted by the rulers as being in some sense normal or socially desirable and in everybody's interest. And this is ensured very largely through civil society, as he calls it, i.e. through a whole network of practices and institutions, often quite independent of the state, although sometimes connected with it, sometimes even dominated by it, churches, schools, press, media, associations, clubs, cultural institutions, or whatever. Ruling class domination is based on an intertwining of state and civil society, of rule and hegemony, of power and consent. And he stresses this at very considerable. And moreover, he says, that in particularly in the developed bourgeois society in the West, unlike, for instance, Tsarist Russia, where civil society, in the sense of these unofficial networks, unofficial in some sense of having to some extent an autonomous existence, it doesn't mean that they are not influenced by or may not actually be increasingly taken over by the state too, that in a place like Tsarist Russia this kind of civil society was unusually weak, although I think in other respects I'm not sure that Gramsci is totally right in that, but in the West it is enormously strong because indeed the development of bourgeois society consisted very largely in the creation of this kind of civil society. The whole essence of a bourgeois society, of capitalism, is that the government doesn't do a great deal, it keeps itself in reserve, but the economy and most other things are supposed to be run, as it were, via private arrangements, unplanned arrangements, and it is around these that, of course, the whole complex of civil society grows. And indeed, the political constitutions of most bourgeois regimes encourage, and always did, for instance, in 19th century Britain, the foundation of any number of independent groupings, associations, voluntary or other institutions. Now, while this idea is by no means incompatible with what Marx and Engels wrote, even though they too tended to simplify their theory for agitational purposes, for instance, by defining the state in the Communist Manifesto simply as the executive committee of the ruling class, neither Marx nor Engels actually, when they wrote theory, treated it just like that. But I mean, for pamphleteering purposes, it was a good agitational phrase. So, in spite of the fact that this isn't incompatible, as Marx and Engels wrote, the Gramscian approach did break with the main trend of the revolutionary tradition, both Marxist and anarchist, because these saw the issue as exclusively one of class power and a failure of workers to draw the revolutionary conclusion. They saw simply as due either to backwardness or stupidity or to being brainwashed or misled or corrupted, or, of course, to treason by leaders or by unduly favored minorities, which in turn had been bought off or corrupted. In short, they weren't, of course, this isn't, of course, altogether wrong. We can find examples of all these things, up to and including the corruption of leaders. But it's inadequate. In short, this, so to speak, agitational tradition of the movement, which is very strong, which is still strong in some activist centers, saw somehow or other the exploited and the movement as not actually within civil society, as essentially outside of it, held down and fighting, as it were, from an independent outside point of view. In fact, they saw it, and still to some extent see it, as essentially something that should be like the position, the workers, as something that should be like the position of the Africans in South Africa. Solidly opposed to apartheid, not getting any advantages at all out of it, and held in check essentially only by coercion. Now, a number of fairly fundamental conclusions follow from a Gramscian type of analysis. One of them is that the state and class rule are in fact not usually like apartheid, because apartheid offers nothing to the ruled and has no legitimacy in the eyes of Africans. But the bourgeois state wins consent because it is often recognized, rightly or wrongly, as being in some sense in everybody's interest. It has a legitimacy in the eyes of most people. Maybe it shouldn't have, that's another matter. But a lot of people think it does have, and the reason it does have is that they believe it represents something that is in some sense useful to themselves in two ways. Partly, of course, because, if you like, it represents order, a social order as against disorder or anarchy. That's not an insignificant factor. If you look at a society like Lebanon today, what happens is there is not, in fact, a state. Essentially, the reason why Franco, one of the worst of the regimes, dictatorial, why Franco Spain, why Franco maintained his support, I think, in the 10 years after World War II, 5 or 6 years certainly after World War II, was because people feared what would happen if there wasn't even this awful state guaranteeing something, if it feared a relapse into a civil war more than they feared, as it were, than they disliked and hated, and most Spaniards did at the time hate, a bad government. But also, in a second sense, to some extent, the state and through its hegemon actually does, in a sense, negotiate consent by providing something which people can indeed see as being in their advantage. What this means is that in return the ruling system must make itself to some extent acceptable to the majority of its citizens, if it isn't to rule like the white South Africans in Africa, who rule simply because they've got more guns. And that is, on the whole, a rare and exceptional case, certainly in world country societies. That means that the class struggle, which isn't just for power, but in practice, at least on the part of the rulers, it's also for not losing hegemony. And conversely, for revolutionary movements, the struggle is also a struggle to gain, as it were, the high ground, to get itself accepted as potentially a representative of society, of social order, something for everybody, and not just for its own members. To be accepted as potentially the bearer of consensus for its political project, or the bearer of what Gramsci called the collective national will, or what Marx said, for the proletariat to become the national class. A movement which confined itself to defending or advancing purely sectoral or sectional interests of the working class could not, according to Gramsci, be such a movement which would change society, unless, of course, we assume that the class it represented, the proletariat, formed the overwhelming majority of the country, and at the same time that it was homogeneous, namely that all workers, in a sense, would have the same interests and wouldn't be divided or capable of being divided against each other. Now, nowhere today are the workers the overwhelming majority of the population, the manual workers. They were once upon a time in Britain, not many other places. This is no longer the case even in Britain. The worst aspect of such a sectoral or sectional policy is what Gramsci calls the sort of economic corporate approach, which is that of pure trade union sectionalism, and trade unionism. The sort of trade unionism which is no better, even because, even when it is idealized by parts of the left, whenever its leaders have claimed that they personally are revolutionaries. Now, note, moreover, that the essential of the struggle for hegemony is to win the support of other classes and not only of your own social base. Gramsci's example and inspiration was, historical inspiration, was the formation of Italian unification, in which the class is actually supporting the unity of Italy, or having a direct economic interest in Italian unification, were quite a minority. But this actually also applies to majority